In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, not at Conservative Party conference anymore, back in Red Box Towers in London Bridge. Right, coming up on the podcast today, just moving away from all the stuff. We're not going to talk about pigs. We're not going to talk about petrol. We're not going to talk about politicians and their speeches. In a rare interview, in fact, it's the first interview that he's ever done, Sir Stuart Eldon, former diplomat who now sits on the parole board, who decides who gets out of prison and who doesn't. Opening up about the difficulties in making those decisions. Do some people deserve to stay behind bars forever? So that rare exclusive interview coming up later in the podcast. First, we kick off with our columnist panel. It's Thursday, so it must be Night at the Marriott. It's India Knight and James Marriott. I tell you what, let's start with Boris Johnson's speech. Obviously, it was sort of the big moment we were building up to. Even before it started, a Downing Street source told me there were lots of jokes, no policy and some animals. And that basically sums it up. What did you make of it, India?
Well, actually, talking of limericks, he's a sort of human limerick, isn't he? He sort of goes, bah, 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 bah. And the speech was as energetic and superficially appealing as a limerick and entertaining. And as far as I could see, didn't really have any content. I don't understand at all this idea that he kept coming back to, that we were going to produce only highly skilled and highly paid people, when it seems so glaringly obvious to everybody in the entire country, surely, that the pickle that we're in at the moment, pickle is really kind of understating it, is to do with a shortage of low-skilled people. You know, economies need low-skilled people. There is no harm or shame in being a low-skilled person. And that sort of, you know, I felt that was that kind of rather made his argument kind of completely pointless and a bit dim, because we can all see it. We can see it in empty spaces on the shelves. We can see it in lack of deliveries. We can see it in vegetables rotting in fields, people not working in abattoirs. You know, great to have high skilled people, but we need low skilled people, and we haven't got any, and people aren't willing to become low skilled people when they could be doing something else. So I felt that his failure to unpack that and to address that was really very glaring.
And actually, if he's got such a problem with low skilled workers, he might do something about his cabinet. James, what did you make of his speech?
Yeah, I mean, much the same as India. It was totally extraordinary to compare it to my experience watching Keir Starmer's speech. I mean, not as a non-political nerd, I found the experience of watching Boris Johnson's speech infinitely more entertaining. And the time, I mean, it was about a third of the length of Keir Starmer's speech, but the time flew by. I do think the jokes were good. I appreciated, as a fan of poetry, the Elegy in a Country Churchyard reference. But I mean, obviously, at the end of it, what did he really said of any substance? The kind of things that stuck in my mind were Build Back Beaver, the depravity of pet thieves, and that sort of, those are the main takeaway points, which are probably a sign that it wasn't of immense political or policy seriousness. But I mean, I don't know. I wish I knew how much that mattered and how much people watching it are just sort of like, oh yeah, Boris Johnson projecting the sort of mood of optimism and bounciness, which is, you know, what attracted us to him. He's continuing to do that. Here are some, does it matter that it seems like it's from a different universe? I would be fascinated to know.
Also the idea that everything that's going wrong shows that things are going right. You know, it's a kind of, slightly mind-blowing concept.
Boris Johnson's phoning you up to tick you off and make clear.
I'm just going to
answer your phone, India. That's fine. We know our place in the pecking order. It might be somebody important. It might be the BBC or something. The thing that strikes me, Jane, my sort of big stand back takeaway from the two party conferences. In fact, I think it was something that Boris Johnson said. Was it in an interview on Sunday? He basically said, "It's all going to be fine." And that's essentially his entire pitch, his speech is this upbeat, boosterish, optimistic, you know, it's all going to be fine in the end. Just all cheer up. It's all going to be fine. And Labour's pitch is the it's all going to be fine shtick is wearing thin. And they just hope that people will decide it's not, or, you know, that it's wearing a bit thin, and then they'll come out. And I'm not sure either of them are particularly strong political strategies. It is possible they are both wrong.
Yes, I think you're completely right. I mean, I think the Labour thing about it's all going to be fine, shit wearing thin. I don't know. I think there's probably no bounds to the sort of way that Boris Johnson manages to kind of enduringly appeal. I mean, he's been doing this for he's been in the public eye doing this for 20 years, and it evidently hasn't worn thin for a lot of people yet. And I just wonder that because it's such a sort of unusual, unique way to do politics that. There'll be a lot of people who always continue to just like someone who tells them everything's fine and tells them jokes and is cheery, because so many other politicians don't do that. And I'm not sure it ever will wear thin. I don't think it'll be fine either. But I wonder if when it's not fine, but you keep telling people it's going to be fine and it doesn't wear thin, then maybe if you're Boris Johnson, it continues to be fine for you, if not for everyone else. That's perhaps my main takeaway.
India, are you back with us?
Yes, here I am.
There's something quite interesting about the psychology of politics. And I think the Labour Party, this is a problem for the Labour Party, is that people want it to be fine. And so if someone is this sort of gloomy, the country's going to the dogs, everything's miserable, your kids are doing terribly and all of that, people don't want to believe that that's true, unless you are ultra-radicalised political and you hate the Tories and all of that, in which case, of course, you think that's true. And then the moment you get a Labour government, everything's going to be perfect. But most people want to think that life is going to be all right.
Yes, and they want Winnie the Pooh. They want Tigger. You know, they don't want Eeyore standing in the corner going, oh, dear, this is all very gloomy and there is no hope. You know, it's incredibly depressing where I think people are aware that the country generally is kind of, you know, that things are sort of creaking at the edges and the uplands aren't seeming that sunny at the moment. So, of course, I think people are going to respond psychologically better to somebody who says it's all going to be all right, sit tight, difficult bump in the road, but then we turn the corner and it's blue skies all the way. You know, it's a nicer thing to believe. Unless, as you say, you're very, very politically committed. It's a nicer thing to be told than this is a catastrophe, everything's falling apart and it's going to get worse, even if that latter interpretation is more accurate.
And James, one of the words of comfort season is definitely scum. Deanna Davison, when her and I did the egg and spoon race yesterday, she'd proudly been handing out 500 badges at the Conservative Party Conference with Tory scum written on it. She claimed they were trying to reclaim the word, which struck me as a bit weird. But you've written about this this phenomenon of dismissing opponents as scum, James, and basically it's all completely natural.
Yes, well, maybe natural, but not good. I think it's fascinating. I kind of love the sort of supercharged way that words sort of acquire their meanings and evolve. I think in the sort of age of social media and Twitter, everything happens so much faster. So it was only a few weeks ago that Angela Rayner was calling Tories scum. It's now sort of gone all, it's sort of gone full circle. Now it's been reclaimed and there are Tory activists chanting scum at themselves at their own party conference, which I just sort of find, I don't know, it's just like his words just move so quickly nowadays and it's sort of, it feels hard to, I don't know, I kind of enjoy the madness of it. But yes, yeah, so I basically, this is my opportunity for, I use this as an opportunity to get onto one of my favourite hobby horses, which is about the way that I think people's sort of moral and political ideas about the world work. And the basic argument of my column was, I mean, I think obviously scum, I don't think anyone's scum, I don't think anyone should be calling anyone scum, it's a horrible word, but without getting too deep into my obsessions in evolutionary psychiatry and things, basically I think that all kind of everyone's moral ideas and moral visions of how the world works kind of depend on there being people who you think, you know, are human and who deserve moral, you know, to be treated morally. And almost everyone, I think, has moral blind spots, and there'll be people, whether you're shouting scum at them or not, who you're not really sort of fully considering as human beings at all, perhaps. And this is a basic function of the way that human morality works, the way that evolutionary psychologists tell us it's evolved. We've not evolved to see everyone as human and to think morality applies to everyone. So before we get too superior about everyone calling people scum, I sort of think, I don't know, everybody has that moral blind spot. I hope that's explained it in simple enough terms.
We didn't necessarily align with people who were always necessarily good. We just aligned with people who were the same as us. The thing about the puppets. Explain the puppets.
This is one of my absolute favourite social psychology experiments. It makes me think how fun it must be to be a scientist. So the scientists at the Yale Infant Cognition Centre, who staged a puppet show for children, and in the puppet show, one of the puppets was shown behaving incredibly cruelly, hitting other puppets, stealing their possessions. The other one was shown to be very caring and loving. At the end of the show, all the babies were given a choice: which puppet did they want to take home? All the babies took home the friendly, loving puppet. A few years later, they made a more complex version of the experiment, where they had the good puppet and the evil puppet. But this time, the babies were told that one of the puppets, I think, shared their preference for either crackers or beans. This is apparently the kind of stuff you go for when you're working with babies. And absolutely across the board, all the babies took home the puppet they felt they had this thing in common with their favourite food stuff, rather than the puppet that was behaving morally or immorally. So this kind of very loose sense of connection, maybe, I mean, crackers and beans probably very important to you when you're a baby, but this sort of sense of connection and tenuous kind of group identity completely trumped morality. So a baby would see this kind of horrible puppet, and if they knew they liked the same thing as the puppet, that would be the puppet they sort of preferred. I mean, this sounds sort of, I mean, these things always sound a little bit wishy-washy and stuff. I just think it's fascinating little kind of insight into this really fundamental way that human psychology works, that as soon as we feel this little sense of connection with someone, we're completely willing to overlook their sort of moral bad behaviour. And anyone with a Twitter account can see this every day, that, you know, everybody is, you know, thinks the other side is evil and will overlook all kinds of horrible things people on their own side are doing simply because we just don't see that as immoral. That's just a complete blind spot for us.
I thought it was really interesting. And actually, it's one of those things where, you know, Labour people happen to defend Angela Rayner calling Tories scum because they think the Tories are scum. But obviously, imagine if Boris Johnson had got up at a function and called Angela Rayner scum. We'd have never heard the last of it. India, James has shared his. What's your favourite ever psychological experiment?
That is really putting me on the spot, and I can't think of a single one.
That only really James Marriott has an answer to that question.
James Marriott has an array of psychological experiments to pick from at will. I do not. I'm trying to think, and I just
can I
can't.
can I tell my hunter gatherer story, or are we running?
Yeah, go
on
then
on
if you want to. Yeah, yeah.
Is that a note of weariness peeping into your voice? So the other anecdote I had in this column was I was speaking to a couple of years ago. I interviewed this Oxford anthropologist called Robin Dunbar, who was talking about the way that the moral universes of hunter gatherer tribes exist, and this obviously is the kind of social environment in which humans have lived for most of their evolutionary history. And he was saying that in hunter-gatherer tribes, the word for people in your tribe usually translates to some version of the people. and then you just don't apply the word people to anyone else outside your tribe, whether they're humans or animals or anyone outside the tribe. There will be some kind of word that means the animals, and that's everyone else, and your moral principles don't apply to the people outside your tribe. And I just always think that is such a little interesting, again, another interesting nugget of human psychology, that if we bear in mind, just tells us, you know, I think you should notice it everywhere, there's sort of fundamental human instincts. Anyway, sorry.
It's like bonobo monkeys and chimpanzees. Bonobo monkeys are really amazing, and they live in a kind of completely communal, cooperative way with what looks like kindness. So if the old bonobo monkey who's, you know, ailing starts kind of being a bit rubbish, they help him and they're kind to him, and they may elect another. Actually, I don't even think they have leaders. I think everything is sort of communal. And chimpanzees are incredibly, terrifyingly violent and brutal, and tear the head off the dying chimpanzee and so on. And they live in completely different ways. I don't quite know what my point is, but I'm for the commune.
India Knight and James Marriott then. Of course, you can read them both in The Times and The Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/TimesRedBox. Up next, that exclusive interview with Sir Stuart Eldon from the Parole Board.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for, it's very rare actually, you don't very often hear from anyone from the Parole Board. And it's the first time, Sir Stuart Eldon, former UK diplomat to NATO. It's the first time he's ever given an interview about his work with the Parole Board. So here it is. Let's start right at the beginning, which I always think is a good place to start. Explain the role of the Parole Board. What does it actually do, and how does work cross the Parole Board's desk?
Well, thanks, Matt. I mean, the Parole Board's function is to decide whether certain offenders can be released from prison. Now, it's a common misconception, I think, that the Parole Board sees every prisoner who is released. In fact, they only see about 5% of them. And the board deals with the most serious offenders, prisoners serving a life sentence, prisoners serving an indeterminate sentence for public protection, which is a bit like a life sentence, but which has now been discontinued, and certain extended sentence prisoners who have a determinate sentence with a period in prison and a period outside prison in the community. And we also see a number of recalled offenders, people who've been released but then sent back to prison for some reason, whether they've broken the terms of their licence or committed an offence or something else. So the first thing to say is that the Parole Board deals with serious cases. What we have to do is determined by Parliament. And it's a test that sounds simple, but is actually sometimes quite complicated to reach a decision on. And we have to decide whether it's necessary to protect the public that somebody continues to be detained in custody. So we're very focused on risk. And we have to decide whether the risk somebody poses is low enough to be managed in the community and whether there is a risk management plan in place that will do that safely.
Are you able to give us an example of a case? I don't know if you can probably give us the actual name of the case, but describe a serious case that you've had as a member of the Parole Board. How many of you are looking at that case, and what are the trade-offs? What are the things that you are looking at when deciding whether or not a prisoner A is released or not?
Well, you'll understand I can't get into details of individual cases because the Parole Board's a court-like body, and parole hearings are conducted. They have judicial force. So you'll understand I can't comment on individual details. But what happens really is that somebody's case is referred to the Parole Board by the Secretary of State. After that happens, a Parole Board member, a single member, looks at it and decides whether it can be concluded on the papers without a formal hearing. That happens quite a lot in recall cases, but the case has to be simple enough to be dealt with fairly on the papers. And I should say, obviously, there are two parties to the case, the Secretary of State and the offender. And after its prime focus on risk, the board is very keen to be fair to everyone, to both sides. So if the case is determined for to be fit to be determined on the papers, then that's settled, and the offender has a chance to appeal that hearing and ask for an oral hearing. If it's deemed to be too complicated to be sorted out on the papers, then it goes to a parole board panel. And depending on the case, that can be one, two, or three parole board members. And then a hearing will be held. The board will look at a very large dossier. I suppose the average is about 200 to 300 pages, but the worst I've had is about 2,000. And then decide, after questioning all the witnesses, whether somebody is of low enough risk to be released.
And what are you looking, when you've got 2,000 pages of what? Is that sort of psychiatric reports, records of how they behaved in prison, details presumably of the case that put them in prison, the way they've behaved, the contacts they've had with the outside world? What is in that? What are you weighing up all the time?
Well, all of the above, really, but it depends on the case. We'll always get the judge's sentencing remarks from the trial. And I think it's important also to be clear that the parole board is not retrying the offence. The offence is what it is and the sentence is what it is. We're just looking at risk. So we'll start off with the trial judge's sentencing remarks. We'll usually see a pre-sentence report if one was prepared. Probation do that for the court service. So we'll see what probation thought at the time. And then we'll have all sorts of reports. We'll have details of previous offending. We'll have reports from the prison or probation officer managing the person in prison. We'll have a report from the probation officer who'll be responsible for managing the case in the community. And they'll make a recommendation on whether the person is suitable to be released or not. Then if there are psychological or psychiatric issues, we'll have mental health reports. We may have details from the prison records system about how they've behaved, whether there are any security entries and so on. So it all adds up to quite a lot. And the panel just makes a decision based on its view after questioning the witnesses at the hearing, and that's the prisoner and usually the people who've written the reports. And then it will form a judgment on whether that person's risk is low enough to be released.
I suppose it's such a complicated, fascinating situation that you find yourselves in, because you've got a prisoner in front of you saying, "I'm full of remorse, or I've a changed man, and I'm going to go out into the community and be a good citizen again." And you're sort of trying to trying to test what is going on in someone's head. What sort of evidence can you reach for to get a real idea as to whether or not they're telling the truth?
Well, it's really important both to read the papers you've got in front of you in the dossier, and then actually to listen to people explain themselves. And sometimes the outcome of a case can change quite dramatically. You know, you often read a dossier and you think it's going to go one way on the papers, and then you'll talk to the people involved and then form a view at the end of it all. And sometimes that view can be different. Sometimes witnesses can change their recommendations. But there's a lot of questioning that goes on. I mean, it's a court-like process, but it's inquisitorial. It's based on questioning rather than being adversarial, with the two sides putting arguments against each other. And the board will probe quite a lot. At every hearing, the offender is going to get questioned in real detail and real depth. And we'll form a view on what, or the panel will form a view on what it thinks based on everyone's answers. And although COVID has meant that a lot of parole hearings these days are done remotely on a video link or by telephone, there's no substitute, I think, for being able to gauge a person by watching their reactions. And then the evidence is tested. So if an offender puts forward one argument about why he or she should be released, then the panel will usually test it with the expert witnesses, the parole witnesses. And if there's a psychologist or psychiatrist present at the hearing, then we'll want to hear what they think as well.
And is your starting point, every person who comes before you should be released unless we can find a reason not to, or is it this person has to prove that they should be released? What's your sort of mindset going as you approach each case?
Now, the starting point's really simple, and it's, can that person's risk be managed safely in the community? And that's it. It's all about risk.
And do you think, are there times when you're just stumped by a case that actually, I mean, you just have to make a decision? But so these things are complicated. Human beings are really complicated. And ultimately, I suppose you have to live with the consequences of that decision, the risk that somebody might reoffend, they might go back to abusing a partner or rapists, murderers. You know, these are high-stakes decisions that you're making. Do you feel that pressure?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and every case is different. I mean, one of the reasons I enjoy doing this job is that, you know, after nearly 12 years now, I'm always amazed that something new, something different comes up. So every case is its own. But I mean, it might just help to give you a few figures. Of the 5 to 10% of releasable prisoners that come before the board, only one in four meets the release test. You know, not by no means everyone gets out. It's roughly one in four. That's the statistics. And of those who are released, the serious further offending rate is 0.5%. And while every further offence is a tragedy, obviously, I think that shows that the board takes an awful lot of care over the job it does. So, you know, it is, you're right, it's a difficult position to be in, but we'll attempt to do our job to the best of our ability.
Obviously, with those sort of very high profile cases, it becomes not just sort of a legal debate, but it becomes a very political debate. Probably one of the most high profile in recent times was the case of the so-called black cab rapist John Warboys. He was judged to be safe to be free by the parole board. That there was a big political row about that. That decision was later overturned by the High Court. Do you think that the parole board is, you know, there's been lots of talk about the parole board changing, being more transparent in the decision makers. Do you think that, have enough changes been made to ensure that there's not a repeat of that? Or do you think that that's just the nature of, these are very highly contentious cases?
Well, highly contentious cases are always going to be highly contentious and difficult. I mean, the board would like to be more transparent. And there's an ongoing review of the board going on in the Ministry of Justice. And I'm sure that there'll be some changes in relation to that. But transparency is important, but there are sensitivities that go with it. And you've got to ensure that there's an atmosphere in parole hearings which will encourage all witnesses to speak frankly. And as you've implied yourself, you know, there's a lot of quite difficult and personal stuff that comes out in parole hearings. And we've got to keep on creating the environment where people will speak their minds and speak their minds honestly and, you know, give advice to the board that is honest and represents their views. So that's one thing that has to be taken account of when you consider transparency.
Well, I suppose the thing is that the case that put that person into prison has been played out in public, and people had to give their full and frank and honest account for that. Would it not be better if the parole board hearings were held in public? The press could attend, victims' families could attend, they could see the process being played out, rather than this idea of, when you said you've been doing it for 12 years, and we're very grateful that you're here, but it's the first time you've spoken about it in public. And actually, transparency of us, this conversation is fascinating, but actually the transparency of letting people see what goes on in those hearings would make a huge difference, wouldn't it?
Well, I think the evidence in parole hearings is a bit different from the evidence that that's often heard in court. So that's one thing to say. But I do want to repeat that the board thinks that transparency is important. And this also, I think, leads on to the question of victims, who they're central to the criminal justice system. They're central to the parole process as well. And they currently have the right to read a personal statement in parole hearings, as they do in court. But I think there's likely to be a pilot scheme started quite soon, under which they'll have the right to apply to observe a hearing if they want to. But you shouldn't underestimate the stress of all of this, and the stress cuts both ways. I've seen victims in parole hearings really deeply emotionally moved by going through the process. And it's important that the board takes account of those sensitivities. Equally, I have to say, I've seen a case where an offender has basically gone into a state of nervous collapse on hearing a victim personal statement and has had to withdraw from the process for a while. So you've got to balance quite carefully those sort of emotional considerations. And I do think the evidence, as I say, is a little bit different from what you hear in court.
Although I suppose, actually, I imagine lots of people listening to this would think the prisoner hearing the impact of their crime from the victim is probably part, I mean, you hear that in court cases too, and that's probably part of the process. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was how you feel about these full life orders, the full life sentences. Felicity Jerry QC has written in the Times today saying that the problem with a whole life sentence is it's an exercise in retribution. She says it's too close to the injustice that is the death penalty. Do you agree with that? Do you think that release is part of...
Yeah, that's not for me to say, I'm afraid, as a parole board member. You know, I said earlier, we're not retrying the case. And we've got a job to do. The parameters of that job are well set out by Parliament, and we're simply looking at risk. So I don't think I'd want to comment on whole life orders or not. They're available to the judiciary. They've been approved by Parliament. And I think that's, as far as the parole board is concerned, the end of the matter.
Because that just means it's not a case that will come in front of you. You touched on this root and branch review that the Ministry of Justice are doing. I mean, it was launched a year ago, and we still didn't really know what's happening. We've now got a new Justice Secretary, so I suspect we might be slightly back to square one on that. There seem to be lots of ideas floated around, maybe even renaming the parole board to something that takes more account of, you know, as the risk to release or the actually reflects the decisions that you're making. Do you think that as part of the opening up the process, increasing transparency, renaming it and giving it much more openness should be part of that review?
Oh, heavens. I'm all in favour of openness, personally, but I'm just a simple parole board member. I'll sit there and wait for the outcome of the review. I mean, there's not much more I can say. I mean, there's a lot of issues going on and being considered by the MOJ as part of the review. The board's submitted its own views in response to the public consultation on the review. And I think we just have to wait and see what happens, wait and see what comes out of it all.
I know that Martin Jones, who's the chief executive of the parole board, has talked a lot about the mental health of prisoners, saying the criminal justice system needs to do better at looking at the mental health of prisoners to ensure that they have the support that they need. Is that a failure of the system in order for people to get, by the time people get to the parole board stage, they need to have had that support, don't they, so that they are in a position to be released safely? Is that something that concerns you? Does there need to be more mental health support?
Yeah, it is amazing how many offenders have mental health issues of one sort or another. And that's why the board has got quite a large number of psychologists and psychiatrists sitting as members of it. And yes, I mean, I would favour, people being given the mental health support they need. But, you know, as with the wider NHS, there are resource issues here. So quite often, by the time a case comes to the board, the offender will not have had all the mental health support they need. And one thing the board can usefully do is to jog the system along to make sure that those factors are taken into account, whether somebody remains in prison or is released into the community, because we'll look, in the case of release, at the risk management plan that probation puts forward. And if somebody has mental health issues in prison, it follows that the risk management plan must have some mental health considerations put into it as well.
Do you think, this is a phrase that often gets bandied about in this, in this debate, do you think prison works?
Do I think prison works? Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, I've seen people go through the system and come out having really changed. I've seen other people who've not changed. And I've seen still more people, or still other people, who've become institutionalised. You know, I have a case in front of me at the moment where somebody is 20 years over their tariff. And you can't help but wonder what effect that has on a person.
So that's someone, who's served the sentence as originally handed down by the court.
A life sentence with a tariff, but hasn't been deemed fit for release.
So I suppose in that case, the idea that they've served the sentence they were handed, and then in theory, the system then should prepare them to be able to release. 20 years over, that just suggests that maybe some people aren't able to be...
That's entirely possible. And it all comes down to the basic test of risk I mentioned earlier. To be released on a life sentence, the sentence is life. There's a minimum period set by the sentencing judge before which somebody cannot be released. And then after that, it's a matter for the parole board. And I should say, the parole board doesn't lead to early release. I mean, if somebody has a tariff of 12 years, they will not get considered by the parole board, for example, until those 12 years are up.
Do you think things like, when people hear life tariff, full life sentence, full life order, life means different things to different people in different sentences, as in sentences when people are speaking. Do you think, when some people hear that someone's got a life sentence, lots of the public think that means they're going to spend the rest of their lives in prison, and then they hear the parole board has released them, and that feels like that isn't justice being done. Do you think the language of some of these things would be better if they were changed?
Well, I think language can often get convoluted. I mean, I think that's a feature of all courts sometimes. But it's important that people understand that a life sentence means life, in the sense that somebody will serve his tariff sent by the sentencing judge in prison, but then for the rest of their lives, they'll be on license in the community. And if they break the terms of that license, they can go back to prison again.
Yeah, and I suppose people just need to sort of understand that. It's been absolutely fascinating. We've had lots of people messaging that didn't know about how any of this worked. So it's really nice to have you here to explain it. I did mention at the beginning, you are also a former UK ambassador to NATO. I just wondered whether your diplomatic skills, to what extent do you draw on your diplomatic skills when you are trying to pick through these tricky cases?
Yeah, well, some of the skills are the same. I mean, diplomats have to be able to read large amounts of information and sort out what's really important and what really matters, more importantly. And diplomats also have to have good questioning skills. We've got to be able to form a view about what people are thinking and what they're doing and their motivations behind it. So I think to a great extent, some of the skills are the same. The context is obviously very different. And personally, I find it very refreshing to be doing parole board work as opposed to dealing with foreign affairs a lot of the time.
Prisoners are easier to deal with than other countries' diplomats. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't say anything's easier than anything else, but it's good to have a change.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.